This week in Retronauts, the space we invade, we get by on you. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts episode, I just looked this up. I think 451, 351. It's some 100 plus 51. 451. That is so many episodes. Okay, so for our 451st episode of Retronauts, we're finally giving some attention to one of the really kind of the early defining giants of the medium, a little company by the name of Taito, which is now a little company by the name of Square Enix, which is not that little, and it's kind of weird. But we're not going to talk about that part of their history. What we're talking about today is the really early part of their history. I've kind of broken Taito's history into a few different chunks, and this is the early chunk, the beginning of the company through really the point where they started to make a transition from arcades onto consoles, or at least to, you know, embrace consoles a lot more in 1985. So even though this episode spans, about 32 years of history, it's really kind of heavily loaded toward the late 70s and early 80s. And when I say we, I don't just mean myself, Jeremy Parrish. I also mean some familiar faces, actually. Who do we have on the other side of the line? Let's go with the guy named Ray. Ray, who are you?
I'm Ray. Ray Barnholt, yes. Just out here bubbling and bobbling.
Wow. Bubbling and bobbling. I didn't know that was legal.
Two at once. Quite a skill.
Yes. That's like walking and chewing gum and then spitting the gum at enemies and then bursting the bubble. I don't know. It's confusing. Also, who else is on the line?
It's me. I'm Brandon Sheffield from Necrosoft Games and the Insert Credit podcast. And I didn't want to interrupt you, but I was going to say that maybe you couldn't remember the episode number because you were in a rush. That would have been a lot funnier if it was right after your Space We Invade joke. But just imagine it was right there.
Man,
I like it.
You are the Neil Peart of writing podcast humor about video games and progressive rock. That's a very specific talent. All right. So Ray and Brandon are here to talk with me to you, the podcast listener, about the history of Taito. In this episode, it's been a long time coming. We've talked about some of the other arcade giants, such as Namco, Atari, Williams, probably some others that are Konami, maybe. Yes, Konami. So it's been a long time coming, but this was specifically prompted by the advent of the Egret 2 Mini, which might be the best mini console style device ever. I don't know. Where do you guys stand on this thing? What are your feelings on it? We can talk about this a little bit, even though it really goes well beyond 1985 to 2022.
I mean, yeah. I love the rotating screen. I mean, it's nice to have just a little action that you can do with one of these mini consoles that isn't that feels satisfying, but isn't even the game. And so I think that's pretty neat. It is pricey, which is a tough one for me. Yeah. And I've heard a couple things about a little latency and in some of the games. But otherwise, I don't know. It's a good selection of video games. Taito has some hot stuff, especially in the 90s. But, you know, they got some good stuff earlier on, too. So I don't know. I think it's great. I also do sort of wish it were a similar size to the other arcade machines that are out there. But yeah, what are you going to do?
Yeah, it's a big one. Not so many after all, but nonetheless, it does make a statement, I think. And it is very cool with its rotating screen, of course. Rotating screen that is just like makes a statement itself. It has a big, huge chonk noise that occurs when you push it in and out and stuff. It is pricey, but you get 40 games with it. 10 more, I believe, if you get the paddle controller, which I did, of course. Yeah. And it's just, it's probably the best that these things may get for the near future.
Yeah, I agree with the praises and the complaints. It is pricey, but I feel like what you get for that money is really extremely well made just on the manufacturing side. And I have seen complaints about the latency. I haven't really encountered anything that messed up my experience with it. And I'm pretty sensitive to that sort of thing. So it's not too bad. But the thing I really love about it is, besides the rotating screen, which is nice because I always like to see, vertical games on a vertical screen. And it is a really cool feature that, seems kind of obvious, but also seems really complicated to manufacture and, like a very significant potential failure point for a device. So I kind of can't believe it's actually a reality, but it is. And that's great. But I also really love the spinner controller. Of all these little mini arcade machines, mini consoles, etc., that I've messed with, which has been quite a few at this point, nothing has felt as good and as true to the arcade as that Taito spinner. It's got weight to it, and it's got just the right amount of resistance and give. It's really, really good. And, compare the mini controller and the way it plays Arkanoid to like the VAUS controller for NES and the way it played Arkanoid. And even though they're supposed to be, basically the same device, like the mini just feels so much better, which, the VAUS controller is 35 years old. So maybe that's not a fair comparison, but it's just so well made and so nicely engineered. Yeah. It's very, very satisfying. So yeah,
I think it's neat how the Taito has really felt like they need to keep that spinner controller alive. They did it for the Arkanoid on the DS as well. Mm-hmm. They just like whenever they can, they bring that thing back. And I think it's cool to keep a vintage form of game control that was very important for many years alive. And I also appreciate how back to the screen thing, the kind of removal and reinsertion of the screen is a very simplified representation of the actual action that you have to do to rotate those screens on a real arcade machine. Cause like people may or may not know this, but on most candy cabs, there are screws that you can take out, and then you have to like pull the entire CRT out of the unit, rotate it, slot it back in, and then screw everything back in. But most of those, like the Astro City and Jalco's, whatever the heck that was called, I don't remember what it was called. But all of those, almost all of those had the ability to take out the screen and then rotate it to be vertical or horizontal. And so but the operation was very similar. It was like, do something, pull the screen out, rotate it, push it back in. So I think it's really neat that it's like, it's the same function, just much simpler.
Yeah. I like that Sega just kind of said, that's just too much trouble. Let's just make a separate machine that has a vertical screen. And that's fair, but
it's fair enough.
But yeah, it is nice that it really kind of recreates the whole setup, which is cool. But on the subject of the spinner controller, one thing that I think is great about that is that, so many arcade games did use unique setups. They used controls that didn't carry through to become standards. And a lot of those tend to be given short shrift or forgotten or just really poorly reproduced in modern devices. And so, the fact that they put out a spinner controller and nearly a dozen games that go with it, I think, speaks well to their respect for kind of that legacy. And also an understanding that, yes, these games do play better when you have the proper controller. Like, going back to Arkanoid on NES, you can play that with a D-pad, but it sucks and you're not going to get far because it's so imprecise and it just doesn't have the analog precision that you need. Like, you can't tell the VAUS paddle at the bottom with the D-pad, move only a tiny amount very slowly or move really fast over to the side. It's going to be, a digital action. There's no movement curve, basically, acceleration curve.
Yeah. Which they tried to compensate with, like when controllers had more buttons, the Super NES Arkanoid has you hold the shoulder button to go a little bit faster.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But then you're doing like crazy Street Fighter type button management for a paddle game. And it's fun.
Yeah. So So just having, you know, the game reduced back down to its essence and given that controller for things like Arkanoid and Camel Tree, it's good. And I appreciate it. And I appreciate the fact that they actually manufactured a good spinner as opposed to like Arcade 1-Up spinners, which are terrible and don't feel satisfying at all. So I would love to see more of that sort of thing happen. But I realize it's very boutique, and it works for a boutique product like this, where it's, you know, hardcore game developers really appealing to just hardcore game fans. And it's a small... a very, you know, by nature, a small audience. But as someone who does kind of fall into that Venn diagram, I'm grateful for their fine work.
Yeah, Taito gets it.
So, with that being said, where the hell did this Taito company come from anyway? And the answer is Japan, but it's more complicated than that, because it's actually post-war Japan, where there was a lot of stuff happening. A lot of Westerners set up shop in Japan during that time, and you know, some of those became very important video game corporations, such as Sega. And Taito was one of those. I did not realize until researching that was the case for Taito. I've never really looked into the past of the company, but it turns out it was established by a Ukrainian who had studied in Japan back, you know, before World War II, and then moved to China, and then ended up moving back to Japan when China was taken over by the Communist Party in 1950, and things like owning businesses were suddenly frowned upon by the people in charge. So he kind of jumped back to Japan and started up businesses, you know, dealing in imports and vending, and kind of built around the very real, very undeniable presence of American soldiers, you know, Allied soldiers who had set up bases during the occupation of Japan, and a lot of businesses that came out of that immediate post-war period in Japan kind of had this symbiotic relationship with, you know, American bases and the occupancy. And that kind of was an inflection point from which, you know, a lot of Japanese companies and, you know, sort of the company or the country becoming a, you know, an industrial design, electronics, technology powerhouse in the latter half of the 20th century kind of came out of. And we've talked about this before, but I highly recommend reading the book Pure Invention by Matt Alt, which talks a lot about, you know, the rise of what we recognize as Japanese pop culture, such as video games, anime, et cetera, out of that period of history. But anyway, Taito belongs to that period of history. And that's kind of the baseline. I don't know if you guys want to add anything more to that, if you have insights that I have not shared, but please, by all means.
Well, you're going to talk about the, you know, starting by importing vending machines and doing all that stuff, right? But one thing I think is pretty funny is that in the Taito Memories game on PS2, they suggest that Taito got its start by distributing peanut and vodka vending machines, which is, of course, false. There were not vodka vending machines, but I really like the idea of in the 1950s, there's just like, I don't know, a spigot. You just put right. in a few hundred.
It's like
yen.
A speakeasy.
Yeah. I think they put two things together because they were importing vodka and possibly locally sourcing it. That's hard to track down, but it's likely that they moved along to that Brian Ashcraft was talking about this. They likely moved along to getting some shochu producers
yeah.
to develop a vodka, because you can, if you just switch grains for potatoes, you can start making vodka.
Well, I mean, at this point you can make vodka out of any grain, really. It doesn't have potatoes.
Yeah, it's true.
And actually back then when the standards weren't so lax, but you know, now they have like grain based vodka, and Actually, a lot of companies I've discovered that distillers in Japan that have gotten into making gin create basically shochu based vodka and then add, you know, gin botanicals to it. So maybe that was the original inspiration for it, was the introduction of vodka into Japan by Taito, a future video game powerhouse. It's all circular.
Yeah, but it's neat that Taito came to Japan before Sega. Two Westerners who created two of the best Japanese game companies of all time, both in the 50s. Although, of course, they had nothing to do with the success of the video game portion.
not too much. Although we haven't actually mentioned his name, Michael Kogan. Michael Kogan was the Ukrainian who started Taito. And it seems like he maintained a pretty significant stake in the company up until his death in the 80s. So I don't know how much actual control he had when he stepped back, but you know, he did have a stake in the company of some sort. So you know, you can argue there was some sort of connection there. But yeah, I do feel like this is one of those cases where someone from another country started a company in Japan. It became very successful, and it just kind of gradually became a Japanese corporation, or, you know, was sold to local interests and taken over, and then, you know, maybe taken in a different direction, but still run very well and successfully.
Yeah, that's always really interesting. And I think it also is interesting just like how Sega and Taito and Namco, which is not started by an American, but always involved in first manufacturing machines that are kind of far away from even amusement machines. You know, we mentioned vending machines. I think Sega did some pinball before that too. But yeah, it's always interesting how they just sort of like ended up creating video games and just sort of starting that whole industry. It's always really interesting to me.
Yeah, I think the involvement for both Sega and Taito with vending machines and jukeboxes at the beginning was that, you know, those are electronic amusements, and they use like the distribution system for arcade video games really just kind of took over those channels. It just kind of grew naturally into those spaces because there was a spiritual connection, you know, in the beginning. The division between an electromechanical amusement and a video game was pretty slim. It was like one of these has a television monitor and one of them does not. But otherwise, you know, they tended to cover a lot of the same ground with the same genres of entertainment and amusement. And they tended to involve a lot of the same electrical parts, you know, before TTLs and microchips and microprocessors, they were, you know, all vacuum tube based transistors and that sort of thing. And using that analog technology. So it just kind of became like video games just kind of mutated out of that existing space, just as it did in America.
And also distribution wise, it made a lot of sense because they were all these things operated on coins. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had the whole process for that with jukeboxes and then electromagnetic machines and all that kind of stuff. And it wound up, you know, the same path was followed in Chicago, for example. And that's why you have all these arcade companies in Chicago, because there were already these kind of distribution channels, and it was just like, this is the next coin operated fad that we're going to ride, is these arcade games. It's almost weirder that Atari came out of California. Because everything else was, you know, part of like a really established multi-generational old distribution chain with coin operated amusements, and then Atari comes out of California for some reason, just like from nowhere.
Yeah, it's disruption, baby.
But I guess we shouldn't discount the fact that all of those were all shrewd businessmen, you know, movers and shakers who have control over a market or just know how to jump onto something that they see coming on the horizon and making a bank out of that. Making bank.
Right. So So really the point of all this is that Taito's very beginnings, you know, are unique to the company to a degree, but they're also very familiar and, you know, part of a larger established pattern. And, you know, the company took about 15 years from 1953 when it was established to the late 60s to kind of evolve into a games-oriented company creating their own games as opposed to just distributing things, as opposed to, you know, at the beginning, Michael Kogan was purchasing secondhand jukeboxes from U.S. military bases, you know, that were imported from the Americas for Americans to enjoy. And when they got tired of them or they started to break down, Kogan would purchase and refurbish them and then distribute them within Japan. So, you know, for a country that was rebuilding after, you know, a pretty rough outcome to the war, kind of taking these secondhand entertainments and using those as an inflection point for their own industry and kind of building around those, you know, that was a really big part of the post-war recovery phase there process. And Taito was part of that. And so, you know, by 1967, the company had grown large enough and had enough distribution channels and connections and whatever that it, you know, started to look to create its own devices as opposed to just distributing or refurbishing other people's. And their very first electronic arcade machine was called Crown Soccer Special. And I looked all over the internet and cannot find footage of that machine. But based on photographs, it looks like it's basically a foosball table with a bunch of pinball bumpers set into it, which is, I guess I can see that. It's, you know, kind of taking things that were out there in the wild, concepts that had been, you know, established in the early 20th century and just building on them and combining them. But I do not know how it worked. I have to assume you tossed a ball into the table and it just bounced off the bumpers. I don't know if you had control over the bumpers. There's not a lot of information about it online, but, you know, it definitely looks like a product of its time.
Yeah. I did just quickly find a picture here and it does seem like there's a little slidey little, joystick thing. You move on a little arch and it's just, yeah, maybe you manipulate. You probably manipulate in something one way or another. And yeah, that makes for a fun soccer game, I suppose.
And you know, I realized
it was the 60s.
I have seen this one. I've played it. And I didn't understand what was happening at all.
It probably needed a sheet of instructions pasted next to it. And
yeah, I definitely did not know what was going on with this, but it is a versus oriented game with, it's like a two player thing. But I think there was like some scoring that you needed to do yourself. Like there wasn't like a scoreboard.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely an interesting thing.
Yeah. So they made a few of those for a few years, for about half a decade. And then they started to shift into actual video games. And these were largely created, designed by Tomohiro Nishikaido, whose name should be familiar to video game history fans, but he was apparently the only Taito employee who had a background in electronics. And so the company basically said, so Nishikaido-san, how about you start designing games built around integrated circuits and create, you know, TTL-based logic devices that can make video games. And so he got started, and the first few games Taito created were all pretty much, they look like they're just straight clones of existing games. Again, there's not really footage of these games online. I don't know if these arcade machines still exist readily, and if they do, no one has taken the time to say, hey, it would be good to dump some YouTube footage online of this formative work from a very important video game company. But just looking at the screenshots and cabinets and titles and descriptions of these games, you have stuff like Astro Race, which appears to be from 1973, just a straight up clone of Atari Space Race, also from that year. So I don't know if this was a case of them licensing the game, which doesn't seem likely because there's no indication that they actually did that. I've never read anything about a distribution agreement between Atari and Taito in the early 70s. So I think they just straight up cloned the machine, probably imported one and said, okay, let's do exactly this.
So what I've read is that someone at Sega took Pong apart with the help of circuit diagrams included in the manual to try to figure out where all the signals and chips were going and what they were doing. And so they were first able to create an exact copy of Pong. And then Taito followed suit very quickly, putting out their own Pong cabinet after hearing about Sega's successful test.
Okay.
And so then Taito started importing Pong cabinets after testing it out. But they like Sega and Taito both had Pong clones that they made internally in the same year of 1973. But it seems like it was a real race to beat Pong.
Yeah.
Not to beat Pong, to recreate Pong. That's pretty interesting. That's from the book They Create Worlds.
Oh, so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and something that I've heard mentioned a few times by a few different people over the past, I don't know, year or so, is that in a lot of cases, these clone machines, they weren't really frowned upon by the creators of the original work because, you know, in the early days, there was so much demand for an Atari Pong machine that Atari couldn't manufacture enough to meet demand. And so, you know, their view tended to be, if other people copy this, but we're still selling through our, you know, our maximum yield, it's fine because all they're doing is just creating like awareness of Pong and creating a demand for video games.
Yeah.
So, you know, these things weren't necessarily,
I wonder if they really felt that,
up and up
that way. I'm sure they would have liked to have all that money for themselves.
Oh, I'm sure. But at the same time, yeah, like there were, they just, I think, had to take a pragmatic view. And, it, you know, eventually things would change and people would become a lot more litigious. But in the early days, you know, I think it was, especially when you're talking about companies based in Japan, like Atari didn't have, they were a small company, yeah, at the time. They didn't have that kind of reach. So,
but I can totally imagine Nolan Bushnell being like, God darn it.
Oh, yeah.
Those people over there making money off my stuff. Like, right. Nolan Bushnell, yeah. I don't feel like he was being casual about it. But
yeah, you know, he can't. Yeah, he was probably saying stuff like Raxus Fragans.
That's right.
Probably Al Alcorn, you know, one of these California hippie engineers, yeah, is probably like, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, he's, yeah, probably cool, just blazed up.
We're all part,
like,
of the whatever, great video game community, man. So anyway, yeah, Taito's first Pong clone was called Ella Pong, I guess, like electric Pong. Or, yeah, Elephant Pong? I don't know.
Elephant Pong would be better.
Yeah. It would be really cool, but yeah, it would go right up there with Snoopy Pong as games that should have existed. Yeah. You also had Davis Cup and Pro Hockey, which appear to be sports games. Again, no footage that I can find, but they sound pretty much like multiplayer Pong clones that were just dressed up like, hey, now the little box that you're hitting around is a soccer ball. Hey, now it's a puck. Just use your imagination, kids,
right.
as was the case back in those days. But starting the following year, they really started to, you know, really kind of find their own stride and start making their own games. And so, you know, in the first, I don't know, like 1974 through 77, they started putting out some pretty interesting games, some of which were fairly inventive, some of which were fairly influential, and kind of helped put Taito's name on the map. And again, you're not going to believe this, but I can't find footage online for any of these games. I've never played them myself. So this is all basically like, you know, speaking of elephants, like it's a dark room, we've got our eyes closed, and we're trying to feel out the shape of the elephant and figure out what it is to describe it. But, you know, just kind of going based on that, I would say of all these games, the most influential seems to be Western Gun or Gunfight. Have either of you played these?
You know, I'm not sure because there were other games that were kind of like this. And so I'm not sure if I've played this or one of its you know, follow-ons. But I definitely played something like this at the California Extreme Arcade Expo with cowboys shooting at each other. But I can't be sure if it was this one. I definitely played one that was black and white. So it could have been, but it could have been something else.
Yeah, and it's entirely possible you did play this because it did see official U.S. distribution via Midway, who renamed it Gunfight, where it was called Western Gun in Japan. And, you know, the idea for it was apparently taken from Sega's Gunfight, which was an electronic, like an EM game from 4 or 5 years ago prior. But, you know, this was video game form, and you know, you're kind of moving a layer away from Pong, a layer of abstraction. So, you know, the paddles become cowboys and the ball becomes bullets. And instead of just bouncing bullet, you know, the ball back and forth, each character has the ability to fire the projectile. But then you have obstacles in the middle. You have cacti, you have rocks. So basically it's two cowboys standing on either side of the screen in a desert field full of litter trying to kill each other.
Oh yeah. I have played this. There's also a caravan that goes through the middle that can be a blockade there. And you got a certain number of bullets. Yeah. I played this thing and you shoot the guy in any part and then he falls on his back and says, "Got me." And it ticks up the score. Yeah. I played the Gunfight version of this probably at California Extreme Arcade.
Yeah.
It's very simple, but I can understand how it would have captured the imagination at the time because the characters are like, those are cowboys. You can see what they are.
Yeah, the characters are characters
and everything.
They got hats. They got little cacti that you can see. You can tell what everything is, which was probably pretty mind blowing at the time.
Yeah.
And this game, like I said, was distributed by Midway, and I didn't realize it, but it ended up being the first game ever to include a microprocessor as opposed to transistors. The original Japanese version did not, but Midway basically rebuilt the game from the ground up for the US. I assume that when, you know, they distributed it, they weren't importing the machines. They were just building them in their own factories and basically just redesigned them from the ground up to use a microprocessor, which is kind of a big deal. Oh. Basically be the future of video games.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the design of it inspired things like Nintendo's Sheriff and Chisholm Trail on TI-99/4A. And, you know, there's lots of other games, as you mentioned, like tons of people imitated the style. And those are just the two that immediately come to mind. But, you know, this format would be pretty popular. I think Namco had one that was very similar. It may not have been cowboy themed, but the concept, you know, it was there. So I think you can look at this and really see like, hey, this is the first time Taito did something that wasn't just, you know, kind of riding everyone else's coattails and following the general course of the games industry, but actually putting something out there that was new and interesting and different.
Yeah. So can we call it the world's first arena shoot 'em up?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
We would not have Unreal Tournament 3 without Gunfight. And it seems like military shooters was kind of their thing. That was what they did for a while. The games that really stand out from this period were also, you had Attack, which footage actually does exist for this. There's like not direct footage, direct feed, but I did find some footage of two people playing an Attack cabinet. And it's basically a shooting gallery where each player has control over like a mounted machine gun with, you know, iron sights and everything and handles like they grip with both hands and it's on a pivot. Each gun is on a pivot. And so you're aiming at the screen and firing. I don't know. I couldn't find any information of whether it's a, like a light gun game or if it's based like that, you know, measures aim some other way, but it was kind of impressive looking because if you look at the screen of this game, there's a pretty revolutionary parallax effect where basically enemy vehicles are moving back and forth across the screen and you're just trying to shoot as many as possible. And the ones at the front are larger and they move across the screen really quickly. And the ones in the back are very small and move very slowly. So you get these layers of targets, which, you know, I feel like for 1975 or 76 was probably also a little bit mind blowing, like, wow, so realistic. These are lifelike graphics.
And just coincidentally, like 15 years later, SNK would make an arcade game that looks a lot like that with the guns and stuff mounted on the cabinet called Mechanized Attack.
I see. So it's just ripoffs all the way down.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Of course. I mean, that's the business, right?
Right.
And such great branding too. Attack, Western gun, everything's called Pong, et cetera, et cetera.
Another game that really caught my attention from this period was called Interceptor, which was also a military shooter. But this one was this one's kind of different in that it's basically it uses a vertical monitor to simulate being inside a gunnery station of, I guess, like a B-52 bomber or something. So you've got like the gunnery window, the frame of the window kind of outlined on the screen ahead of you. And then there's a targeting reticle in the center, and basically you see fighter planes in profile, and they have a scaling effect where they get larger as they come closer and smaller as they recede into the distance. But the actual movement of the targeting is very, very smooth, and it's not you're basically the concept is that you're aiming, you're rotating the entire gunner station. So instead of like moving the reticle around the screen, the reticle is fixed in the center of the screen. And so all the things you're trying to target move around in the background behind that. And as they move around, they move very smoothly in all directions. And it's a very convincing effect despite being, you know, black and white monochrome graphics with solid color sprites. Like it still has this kind of fluidity to it that is very unusual for a game of that period.
Yeah. The gunner cockpit shape is pretty convincing. I think that's part of what helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like they had some really interesting ideas for how to simulate, the sensation of what you see in the real world, and to kind of simulate that as much as possible, as closely as possible, within the extremely abstract limitations of that era's visual technology. So, yeah, like I look at these games, and obviously they're super primitive, they're super early, but like I can see, walking into an arcade in 1976 and seeing Interceptor and being like, "Whoa, this is so cool! This is really amazing!" So, it's a good showing for Taito.
Yeah, it's important to remember that in those early days, the advances, they seem sort of subtle to us now, but they were definitely leaps and bounds at the time, because people were just developing the technology to even display anything on the screen simultaneously with creating games for it. And so it was the era where if you came up with a new, like, if you came up with a microprocessor, that changed everything. And if you got the ability to put multiple colors on screen, suddenly that was like 2x impressive to what had happened previously. It's just, things were moving in leaps and bounds, but the leaps and bounds were so incremental in terms of where we are now. But back then it was just like, by the time you get to games that had 4 or 5 colors like banded across the screen, it was just like, holy crap, how much more realistic are we gonna get?
And Taito would create one of those games very soon. Before you got there, you had a lot of clones. Like they were putting out original concepts, but they were also putting out clones of games like Sprint and more Pongs, just like anything that was popular in arcades in America. Taito had their own version of it at some point. But we do get to 1978, and that's when everything really changes. And Taito says, what if we put cellophane bands of color across the screen? How amazing would that be? We could have black and white graphics, but everyone could think they're color. And the world said, wow, this is the greatest game ever. That's entirely why Space Invaders was popular, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's it. Just that. The end.
Okay, yeah. There's nothing really to say about this. I mean, like, you know, it showed up as a joke on Futurama once, I think, and was otherwise pretty much forgotten.
Yeah, Space Invaders was quite the phenomenon. And I guess this is really what cemented Nishikaido's legacy since he designed it. But when you look at what was available and then you look at Space Invaders, it's got a lot of different elements to it that make it more engaging. It's very responsive, mm-hmm. but also it's like, it's not instant. You're shooting these invaders. To anyone who's never played Space Invaders, you've got a multiple rows of aliens that are moving to the left and right and then down and then to the right and then down. And they're coming toward you and your settlement or whatever it is that you're guarding, and you're a lone tank trying to shoot them all. And you have four barriers that can slowly be broken down by enemy shots and your own shots. And just with those very few elements, they created so much intrigue and strategy, because you know exactly what the enemies are going to do. They're going to move to the right and then down, and they're going to move to the left and then down. It's just like, you know what they're going to do, except for when they shoot. And they shoot and they make this sound, but you can actually hit their shots. You can destroy their shots to some degree. But you have to be straight dead on with the right pixels to do that. And your ship is wider. And so if you're off, then you get shot. But you could also shoot a path through your own barrier to shoot the invaders, or you could, and then there's like the UFO that goes by that you can hit for bonus points. But there were so many, like, you could actually develop strategies. And since the shots are slow enough, you would always feel like you could dodge, and it never felt unfair when you got hit because it was approaching you. You could see it all happening. So it really just had, like, it was a big leap from what was there before, because it was so, though it was a single player game, it had so much strategy in it, and you could talk about it with other people, and to be good at it was impressive. And you know, it has progression. It's everything's in there, and it's really like maybe the first modern video game, I guess.
For sure.
Yeah, and you know, this game did kind of emerge, as far as I'm aware, from that tendency to sort of clone games and try to add something new to them, because by a few accounts that I've read, Space Invaders was inspired by Atari's Breakout, which, you know, in turn was basically like single player Pong. So you take Pong, where you have two people hitting a ball back and forth with paddles, trying to get the ball past the other person's paddle. You turn that on its side, take away the player two paddle, and replace it with just bricks that you're trying to hit, which will reflect the ball once you hit the ball with the paddle. And then you take away the bricks at the top and turn those into, you know, to aliens that are constantly descending, like in Super Breakout, and also can fire at you. And so, you know, just by adding like these minor elements, these minor, like tweaking minor details or, you know, elements of the game, you come up with something completely different. And Space Invaders, you know, some of the more, I think, compelling elements of the game emerged organically, or even by accident, by chance. Like, you know, the way the invaders speed up as you take them out, and the numbers of aliens, the ranks reduce. That wasn't actually, from what I understand, a designed element to it. That was not intended when the game was first put together. But it's just when the processor no longer had to, you know, to manage all those aliens, then it just caused the ones that remained to move faster, because it was just speeding up the processing routine.
Huh, yeah.
I don't know if that's true. That might be ephemeral, but I have read it in, you know, I don't remember exactly where, but it seemed like a reliable source, something that I believe, but
that would be funny if it were true.
But it may be one of those cases where the idea wasn't there originally, but then the processor or the system behaved a certain way and they said, oh, that's actually really great. Let's go with that. And so they just kind of, you know, refined it to become a play mechanic. A little bit like the bug in Ninja Gaiden for NES, where if you die at the final boss, you get sent back three stages instead of one. And the designers were like, oh, that's really hateful and mean. Let's keep that. That's really great. But this, you know, instead of being an act of loathing and contempt for players, was in fact just a really cool element that adds some dynamism to Space Invaders. So the enemies, the aliens, aren't always marching at the same speed, but the better you perform, the, you know, kind of the higher the intensity of the play becomes. So you only have three little targets to hit, but they're moving at twice the speed of the other invaders. So it's no longer a shooting gallery, but more like, you know, a desperate attempt to line up your shots and avoid letting the aliens get to the bottom and end the game.
Yeah, you have to lead them at that point. You have to shoot well in advance of their arrival at that spot. And so you have to really know the speed of your shot in order to get them when they're moving fast. I really appreciate that legacy of game design iteration where, you know, in a way you can track it all back to Pong, because it's there's other early games, but a lot of stuff came from Pong, and indeed Breakout being an evolution of that and Space Invaders being an evolution of that, but in such a way that it feels like its own thing. And I love that kind of stuff, because you know, like first person shooters sort of all came from Wolfenstein or whatever. I mean, there were other earlier first person type games, but Wolfenstein was the first really successful one. But like Apex or Overwatch doesn't play like Wolfenstein by any stretch.
Right. Yeah.
And it's just I love to see the iterative approach that is like, it's this, but like this. It excites the imagination, I would say.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would look at Space Invaders and say, oh, well, that's just Pong.
Just sideways. Another Pong clone.
Yeah, it's totally its own thing. And I think there's a tendency in Japan to look at that as like, oh, this is the first truly Japanese game. Like, this is the first game that we made here. And, you know, it was a huge, huge hit at the time. And Invader Mania is what you always hear about. And, you know, just looking back at interviews with game developers from the early to mid 80s, looking back at pop media of the day, like, you know, anime and that sort of thing, it's just pervasive. Like, it does cast this influence over everything. And, you know, you see throughout the 80s, when you look at Japanese arcade games and what was successful on consoles, the vertical shooter, you know, was huge there in a way that it never was here. And I really think you can trace that back to Space Invaders, because that was kind of this inflection point. And, you know, it really sort of drove the design and also the tastes of games and people who love games. And it's just interesting to see the influence it had, because Space Invaders was popular here, but not to the degree that it was in Japan, where, you know, entire like lounges were set up, you know, bars were set up around just cocktail style Space Invaders games, not arcade games, but specifically Space Invaders. It was just, you know, inescapable for a long time.
And they made like 300,000 units or something like that. I mean, at least in 1 year, they made 300,000 units, which is a lot of arcade machines. They had to create additional manufacturing plants to meet demand for the number of Space Invaders machines. Like, that's a lot of machines. That's a lot of copies of a regular video game to sell, frankly, and to sell an entire arcade machine. And they cost a lot to make and purchase. So, like, it really says something.
Yeah, my understanding is that, you know, in the late 80s, selling 30,000 units of an arcade cabinet was like, wow, great. You've got a hit here.
Yeah.
So selling 10 times that, you know, 10 years earlier is just unthinkable. And that's, you know, I'm sure that's just within Japan, not even counting what made it overseas,
that was Japan.
Manufactured overseas. I don't know off the top of my head our numbers of other hit arcade games, but that's definitely got to put it in like the top three or four best-selling arcade games of all time.
Probably.
Yeah, that's a big number for pretty much any arcade game.
Yeah.
And, you know, these days, Taito still kind of, despite being a division of Square Enix, you know, having been absorbed, it still maintains its own sort of identity within Square Enix and a lot of its own, kind of its own autonomy, which is very unusual for an acquisition like this. Like, you look at Konami and you don't see like, oh, yeah, it's those Hudson guys doing their Hudson thing. No. Like, Hudson is just, it just disintegrated into Konami.
Yeah, it's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. And that's usually the case for these acquisitions. But Taito still has autonomy and they still, you know, have their own identity. And I was actually surprised. It was probably 15 years ago when I, you know, put in a request like, hey, can I go interview some of the creators who are still at the company, you know, who worked at Taito, and then talk to them. It was like, oh, they are still Taito. Like, they don't identify as Square Enix. And that seems to be the case still. And, you know, I think a lot of their identity and a lot of their maybe kind of special treatment hinges on this game. Like, it's such an important cornerstone of the industry. It's, you know, prestige for Square Enix to own the rights to it. But I think it also, there's prestige in saying like, oh yeah, the company that created this, like they're still here. They're part of us and they, you know, they're still going strong. And I think you also see some of the very proud pricing that Taito attaches to its modern games are still very much a part of, like, you know, where would video games be without us? Like, you know, this is kind of our right to price, you know, a physical Switch game at $60 because it's freaking Space Invaders, man. Like, we did this. What would you even be doing right now if we weren't here?
Yes, to say nothing of the Eager 2 Mini.
That's right. Yes. I mean, Taito is still making arcade games. Like, they're still making good arcade games. Like, Groove Coaster is fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, and there's still, I don't know,
Densha de Go. It's a brand new one. Yeah.
It's like they're actually making, you know, kind of keeping the arcade alive in Japan to some extent. They have not stopped trying to innovate over there. And it's really impressive, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, every once in a while I'll just, you know, discover, oh, Taito just released a new arcade game and it's something, you know, but it's this wild new take on it, like you know, Elevator Action Death Parade, where it's like a you know, basically Attack, you know, their 1970 game, the 1975 game Attack, but instead of you know, holding a machine gun, you're holding a rifle, and there are elevator doors constantly opening and closing, and you have to like shoot enemies while the elevator doors are open. So, you know, all kinds of interesting stuff. And Space Invaders, you know, they took this game that was a musty old concept from 30 years earlier, back in the late 2000s, and said, what if we made it trippy and cool and super energetic? And, you know, you got Space Invaders and, Space Invaders Extreme, Infinity Gene, right. You know, kind of all those modern day sequels, and they were really cool. It was like, whoa, here, you know, kind of they've harnessed this black and white style, this extremely dated art, and they've made it somehow feel very fresh and contemporary, and it's exciting and energetic. And yeah, so I really respect that. And the fact that, you know, they do sometimes put out collections of Space Invaders. I think there's one that just came out for Switch that has like a lot of Space Invaders, but they've never done one that has every Space Invaders. Where's my Space Invaders virtual collection, that I ask you?
Yeah, what the heck?
Yeah, I need those Virtual Boy Space Invaders games so I don't have to spend $1,000 on the cartridge.
But by the way, actually played Elevator Action Death Parade?
No, I haven't.
In the arcade? It's interesting because it has physical elevator, it has doors that open when you it's pretty fun. I love that stuff.
Yeah, I was aware of that. I guess I didn't make that clear, but yes, they are actual like physical doors that open to reveal the screen. It's
yeah,
I would love to play it someday. I've just never seen it.
It's pretty fun. I think it was at one of the round one arcades around here at one point, or maybe in Los Angeles, I forget. But yeah, it's not the best game in the world, but I just love I love when there's a physical aspect to a digital arcade game. It just, it feels like something, which is pretty fun. With Space Invaders, yeah. We should talk about,
I was just going to say arcade games are kind of unique in the gaming space because they can subsist just on a really interesting novelty that, you know, it's not going to hold up for release. But when you go to a location and you're putting in, you know, at this point, probably $1 to play, like, sure, give me a game with actual elevator doors. I want to see that Otis stamp on there. I want, you know, I want to hear the doors slowly slide open and the music in the background. It's I need that. For $1, maybe not for like a $40 home game that couldn't possibly do that.
Arcade machines need to have some unique gimmick that means you can't play it at home. You know, like talking about Groove Coaster, you know, I love that game, but it needs the controller, and playing it on the Switch is, I mean, first of all, the Switch doesn't have a controller that works. And if it did, that would be really nice. But it's hard
to play. It works for a little while and then it stops.
Yeah, it's tough playing a rhythm game on there. I would love if Taito would release a real peripheral for that so that you could actually play it in your home. But it really needs that, those input devices, those twisty paddle, weird looking knob guys that they use for Groove Coaster. I love that stuff. But I was going to say about Space Invaders, we should talk about the alleged 100 yen coin shortage, because it is very widely reported that the game was so popular that it created a shortage of coins across Japan. And I think that was even in the Taito Memories collection,
right? Yeah,
that was reported as fact in there. It is, however, not a fact. There's no no indication that anything like that occurred. You can look at the minting year by year of 100 yen coins, and it remains relatively consistent. There's no big bump where we had to triple or quadruple the amount of coins that we're making over here. And it also doesn't really make sense, because when you think about, like, those coins aren't out of circulation if they're in a machine. They're like, Taito's not hoarding the coins. They want to use that money, you know? So it's interesting that particular inaccuracy has persisted for so long that I had to actually do some proper research last night. I read some like research papers and stuff, because it's such a pervasive lie. It's hard to disprove.
True. Well, if I had 100 yen coin for every apocryphal story about the arcade industry,
there would be a coin shortage.
Very good. Yes.
Yeah. You just got to keep them in circulation, Ray. I mean, it's honestly at this point not that hard to believe that, you know, availability and access to 100 yen coins was impacted for people for a while, just because
maybe they were being
directed
regions.
Directed to this one area of the economy. You know, we look at now in the pandemic era, like America has had kind of a coin shortage of sorts, because people aren't circulating cash as much. And so you go to places and they're like, exact change only, we don't have coins. So, you know, things do happen. But yeah, like I was under like the impression. The opposite,
because that's because the coins aren't circulating. And this would have been that the coins are massively circulating and everybody would be jangling around with 100 yen coins so they could play Space Invaders.
I'm just saying that systems are systems are more delicate than I think we previously recognized, and we're kind of having our eyes made, you know, opened to that reality. But yeah, I was always under the impression that that was apocryphal, based on some different things I've read. So hearing you have actually done the work and confirmed it is in fact a lie. It's nice. Thanks for doing that.
Certainly. But I did read that there was one reported incident of, and of course this could have been a news story stunt as well, but a car that Taito was using to transport the 100 yen coins from one location got a flat tire because of how heavy it was.
Boy.
So there's
the only thing that ever causes flat tires.
Yeah.
Anyway, the point is Space Invaders, a big deal. And, you know, I really feel like the international success of Space Invaders, and especially the success of Space Invaders in Japan, put Taito in a really unique position where they could basically do anything they wanted. I would say,
yeah, they had money.
I kind of feel like in some ways they had more liberty and more power, more clout than Atari did in the US, because Atari wasn't wholly self-owned. Like, it was owned by Warner at that point. And so they had to kind of, you know, follow corporate edicts to a certain degree. And those became more and more imperious as the American business sort of became more challenging. But Taito basically, you know, they rolled their own, and they were extremely wealthy all of a sudden, and, you know, had international reach. They opened up international distribution. They had access to, I would say, anything they wanted in terms of arcade game making at that point. And you see that in the sort of immediate post-Invaders era. Like, obviously, they put out a Space Invaders Part 2, which I believe just added actual color to the graphics. They made a Space Invaders for a color screen as opposed to a black and white screen with cellophane bands.
Yeah, and that it still had the kind of cellophane-y look to it, though, because it was still like horizontally across. You could have mm-hmm. color, which makes me think there you could make a perfect ZX Spectrum port of it.
Because no color clash here, friends.
Similarly. Yeah. Oh, I wanted to say one more thing about Space Invaders that we didn't discuss. The original is that I feel like this is one of the first, if not the first game with important sound design. Mm. Like, it was just very simple. Doot, 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 doot. But it was a song that, I mean, you know, other games had, they play little tunes and stuff, but this was like, it was unique and distinctive, and you knew exactly what that sound was. And the sound of the shot was distinctive and unique, mm-hmm. and
it whistling sound.
It's like it's a sound that you can, if you've ever heard it, you can recall it to mind. And Taito was later very well known for their arcade sound design and their mm-hmm. music, and so I think Space Invaders was the start of that. Like earlier games, for example, Western Gunfight, they would use little bits of classical music that they would play or something like that, and that would be what the sound was. But this was fully original sound, and it wasn't even music, but it was so a part of the game and the culture around it. So I just wanted to make sure that we talked about that, because, you know, Zun Tata is a famous arcade music creating group, and that its origins are not in Space Invaders, but they started not too long after that, in the early 80s. So
Yeah, the soundscape of Space Invaders is very, very integral to its appeal. And I kind of realized that, I mean, I always knew that, but I recently covered, created videos about Space Invaders ports to the SG-1000 and to the Famicom. And I was surprised that the Famicom version doesn't really work for me. I mean, it, like, the gameplay mechanics are a little off, but the thing that really it's really missing is that sound design, like the March of the Invaders, the doon, 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 doon. Like, it has no power to it. And the bullets, you know, the shots you fire, they don't sound right. And that really, it's such an important part of the game to kind of have that audio texture. You know, it's such a simple game. There's not much to it, really, that you have to get all the elements right. Otherwise, it kind of, you know, it's diminished. And that is, you know, it's a very iconic sound. I mean, YMO had, I think it was called the Invader's Return or something.
I thought it was
maybe just Theme from Invader. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it you know, it samples that sound, that march sound and the firing shots and everything. And it's, you know, it immediately says, oh, this is a video game song, a song about video games. And you know, I have to imagine that people listening to YMO back in the early 80s were like, oh, it's Invaders. Love those guys.
And what's wild about that is that YMO was, you know, to some extent, clearly influenced by the sounds in Space Invaders when they were doing their early electronic music in Japan. And then they made that song Raideen, which is basically like every video game soundtrack for the next 10 years is what that sounds like. And when you talk to famous game composers like Jun Fukuda, who did, who worked at Grasshopper and, Earth Defense Force and a bunch of like did the soundtracks for Silver Case and other really well-regarded things. You ask people like that, who were their early influences? They'll always be like, oh yeah, well there's this song from YMO called Rydeen. It's like literally a huge major influence on the Japanese game music scene. And that in turn was influenced by Space Invaders, which is pretty impressive to me.
So moving on from Space Invaders, Taito basically had as much money as God at this point and all kinds of clout. And, you know, they were one of the first companies to produce video games, arcade games based on media licenses, media properties. I don't know the exact history of media properties in Japanese arcade games, but their Lupin the Third game from 1980 was a very, very early game based on media. Like, you know, Atari did Star Wars in 1982, and I think that's when Star Trek from Sega came out. So this predates all of that. And you have, you know, kind of a maze chase. It's a little like Lock and Chase, although it actually might predate Lock and Chase.
Yeah, I think so.
But, you know, Lock and Chase does have a character named Lupin, so there's that. But this is, you know, theoretically based on the cartoon Lupin the Third, and it's a pretty simple game where you have like eight treasure bags at the top of the screen, and there's kind of a screen maze and a bit of a Pac-Man Rally X style, and then a vault at the bottom, and you can go and take two bags at a time and carry them while avoiding guards and dogs. I assume one of those is, you know, Zenigata. And when you're carrying a bag or two bags, one of the dogs is Zenigata. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you're carrying a bag, you move more slowly. So there is this kind of consideration that you're easier to catch and you need to kind of stay out of the way of the guards. But it's pretty simple, but you know, it's neat. It's okay. It's fine. But the interesting thing about that to me is that, it seems like this was a tie-in with like a cross media sort of tie-in, because around the same time, the Lupin the Third television series that was running courtesy of TMS had an episode called Is the Invader Safe Open, which is about a caper where Lupin is trying to crack a vault that is protected with a video game based defense mechanism. And it uses like visuals and sound effects and audio effects from Taito's Space Invaders. So I feel like there was this like, you know, kind of a gentleman's agreement between the two companies to, you know, to kind of cross promote one another. And I don't know if that's true, but that's my assumption. I was given the opportunity to do a DVD commentary track on this episode a few years back. So I did some research into it and really couldn't find anything formal, but it's interesting. And it's like this kind of fun little cross media connection for Taito, Lupin, and Space Invaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gentleman's agreement seems like a reasonable way to put it, because the game doesn't really resemble the Lupin universe. No.
You're trying to steal money to impress your girlfriend who you take money to, and then she says, no, it's not enough, give me more, which isn't really that.
It's like a bad memory of Lupin the Third, like someone who had seen one episode and just like, yeah, I think that's what it was about.
There's a guy and steals stuff and there's a woman he likes. Yeah, that must be it.
Master Thief. Yeah, he's taking bags of money. That makes sense. But yeah, it is an interesting game. It's kind of fun. It's a little bit challenging because the mazes are like kind of tiered and hard to wiggle through. And there's always guys chasing you. And then as you go up through the levels, there's like more guys and more dogs. And then you really have to manage whether you can even carry more than one money bag at a time once it gets a bit later in the game. But it is a decent challenge. It was surprisingly good, in fact. And it even has a bit of the Lupin music. So I guess that's how they solved that tenuous connection.
I mean, it's got to be officially licensed.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because there were So I'm sure some money has exchanged hands, but there were definitely some earlier games. Like there was a breakout clone that was, you know, Spaceship Yamato, but was it official? Very unlikely. Because I was in the 70s. So, you know, this is probably one of the earlier official real licenses where money exchanged hands versus things that were just like, I'm going to do this.
Yeah, it has the border art from Lupin on the Egret 2 Mini, at least. And
nice.
That's official. It's just like, well, they probably finished the game first. And then the Lupin people are like, hey, how about this? Huh?
Yeah,
I'd buy it. Let's see some other games from this period. You had Stratovox, which Taito did not create. It was a Sunsoft game, but they did distribute it internationally. So, you know, that was kind of a sign that Taito had expanded into the US market on their own. And it's also notable because Stratovox got its name because it had voice synthesis in it. So that's another, you know, you can understand why Taito might have been drawn to it, because, hey, sound factors in here. It's kind of a big deal. It's innovative. And then there is Kix or Quix. How do you guys like to pronounce this one?
I go with Kix, but if you look at Japanese Wikipedia, they say Quix.
I have Japanese game boxes that say Quix. So yeah, it's a doozy. But I think the American creator has said... Like this was actually designed, I think Quix was...
Yeah, it's an American game.
Kix, yeah, right. But Taito made it big. They brought it to arcades, and it's pretty rad.
I mean, it's I believe it's made by Taito America, because they started an American division in the late 70s, and that's why they were able to bring Space Invaders to the U.S. without a bunch of other branding on it. So, yeah, Kix is a great... excellent game in my opinion, and it really didn't quite get its due in terms of, you know, that particular mechanic never really got fleshed out as much as I feel like it could have, but it did spawn, like,
funny you should say flesh,
Volfeed. That's right, Volfeed, and then of course Gal's Panic, which is why we would talk about flesh, where you're playing Kix in order to reveal scantily clad young ladies. But the mechanic is really cool. If you've never played it, you're a little ship that can only run on the borders of the screen, but you can press a button to leave the border and go to the inside of the screen, and then secure space by encircling, by connecting the edges. And so then you can run along that space, and you're trying to capture usually over 75% of the screen space by doing that, as enemies are moving along the border and trying to get you, and moving inside the internal space to destroy you when you go off of your safe area. I don't know if I described that very well, but it's actually super fun to play.
I would add it's kind of like an Etch-a-Sketch with boss stages.
Yeah, totally. It's like Etch-a-Sketch with a failure state.
Yeah.
Where if you etch the wrong sketch, then you're smashed. But it's super fun. And I think, you know, the sequels are better, but the initial mechanic of that it's really good, and it's smart and innovative. And you can tell it's an American game because it's got all this like wild color cycling, and it has particle explosions and stuff, stuff that they did in the early 80s over there.
Yeah, it has a like Defender Tempest kind of look to it.
Yeah. Yeah, the only thing I don't like about the first Kix is the fuse that can happen. Like if you are too long, too far away from your home zone, your line can start to get destroyed by a fuse that will come to blow you up. That's like too much pressure. There's already enough pressure in that game. I don't need another.
Yeah, I do like how the game has like very, very self-evident risk reward, in that the more territory percentage you can claim in a single move, the higher your score will be.
Yeah.
So there's an incentive there to really take risks and try to just go for it and avoid all the hazards and say, you know, I'm gonna take my chances and try to really, really draw a big line or close off a really huge area. And it can blow up in your face, but if you pull it off, then your score is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
So it's a game that has a very simple concept very, very simple gameplay, but encourages you to just go buck wild and do ridiculous, risky things.
Yeah, I love it. I have to say, I think that this is one of the first Taito games that feels modern. You could play it today for an hour if you wanted to and have a good time. Maybe not a whole hour, half hour, 45 minutes, something like that.
Oh yeah, I think it varies. It has the same appeal as a puzzle game in that sense. Like you don't have to see it all the way to the end or infinite end or whatever. Yeah, it's pretty good just to while away some time.
Yeah, I feel like this is one of the first games where it's like you could put a modern player of video games in front of this game and they would have a good time for long enough. Like they would decide to put it down rather than be like, okay, I've seen enough. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a good enough game that Nintendo picked it up to release as a first party developed title
right.
on Game Boy like 10 years later. So yeah,
that's how I discovered it.
Yeah. I think a lot of people did.
I discovered it through the weirdest possible vector, which is that there was a doujin game called Sentimental Shooting, which was it was almost kind of like you were trying to shoot all the parts of clothing off of a lady. It was a terrible idea.
That is very sentimental.
But it's very sentimental, yeah. I think it was like using the characters from Sentimental Graffiti or something like that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it had like a morphing block at the start of it, similar to how Gal's Panic does, that would determine how much was already revealed and safe. And so I was like, where did that mechanic come from? I tracked that back to Gal's Panic, which is a Kaneko basically Kicks clone. And I was like, well, this is a really cool idea. I wonder where they got this idea. And that's how I discovered Kicks. So it's just like generationally back from like borderline pornography games. That's how I discovered Kicks, which is really stupid and embarrassing. The end.
All right. Well, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Quicks is also tied into my favorite video game. It is in Boku no Natsuyasumi 4 for PSP. You can run up and play it on a cocktail machine.
Oh, wow. It's actual.
It's emulated. Yep. Because it is the only game in that series that takes place in 1985 as opposed to 75.
So they got a Taito license in there?
They absolutely did. And Taito was yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Every time I hear that title, I'm like, wait, whose Natsuyasumi is this?
Okay.
It's my mine. Natsuyasumi.
It's Boku's.
It's not Boku's yours. Natsuyasumi.
So at the other end of the spectrum from Kicks or Quicks, a game that is old but still feels fresh and playable, you have Frontline.
Frontline.
A game that was very influential, really pretty much carved out a genre for itself.
Yeah.
But good God, it's not fun to play. Don't go back.
Not
Don't
fun to play. It. But it's a lot more fun to play. It's perhaps how we were going to say it's like Commando and Ikari Warriors are games that came from this. And it, all the way down to like, you could get in a tank. You're a little, mm-hmm. you're a little guy. You got a little gun that sort of looks like a watering can and you can shoot in any direction, which was the big innovation. And
also it's a vertical scroller that you control the scrolling rate of, and also you can scroll scrolling. Left and right.
Mm-hmm. And
to a certain degree.
Yeah, it's one incredibly annoying aspect is when you they decided that when you move from shooting right to shooting left, that the character should change what hand they're shooting with. And so like you can't shoot directly straight up from your head. You can shoot to the right and up or to the left and up, but not straight up. So you got to move around. But the cool thing was it had a dial to aim your gun. So you could move in any direction and then you could fire in any direction independently. So it's an early twin stick shooter. And it actually plays better when you have the dial because you can actually spin it and you can just like whirl around. It's not great, but it's a little better with the, with the spinner.
I feel like they did miss an opportunity with the Egret 2 Mini. not including Frontline with the spinner as one of the add-on games. Yeah. I don't know if you'd be able to control like with the joystick and the spinner, but I don't see why not. So, you know, since the joystick is built into the cabinet,
I guess it would require some modification of the code of the game, which they probably weren't trying to do. Because when we did the Ikari Warriors games in the SNK 40th anniversary collection, we actually had to hack the ROM to allow for twin stick control because it was a loop lever that controlled it previously, but we actually had to hack it to get twin stick controls in there. So,
oh wow.
That's probably why they didn't do it.
Hmm. I guess it's not worth dredging up, you know, that much effort for this particular game, but it was very influential. There are so many games that came along in its wake and that were so much better, but where would they have been without Frontline?
People loved the idea.
Mm-hmm. All right. So someone added the games Adventure Canoe and Birdie King. I don't know these. Would someone like to talk about why these are worth adding to the list of cool stuff from Taito?
That was me. And these are games that are on the Egret. Well, first of all, Birdie King is part of the paddle and trackball controller games. And it is a trackball based golf game, much like the famous now Golden Tee games.
Is it the first trackball golf game? I was trying to figure that out and I did not determine in time.
I would venture that guess, but yeah, I don't know for sure.
And Birdie King is also notable in that aside from Space Invaders, I think Birdie King is Taito's first successful series because they made three Birdie Kings before 1985. Yeah. And like Birdie King 2 was the fourth best selling game of the year it was released, which was like 82, something like that. So yeah, it's pretty impressive stuff. I guess people love that golf.
Yeah. And it works well. I think again, played it on the Egret and it's a fun little thing to do. And it works like most other sort of 8-bit-ish golf games where you go along the fairway and then you reach the green and it zooms in and you try and putt and simple stuff. And then Adventure Canoe was a kind of somewhat unearthed. It was one of these rare games that not a lot of people knew about or heard of, but it was brought up by basically one of the staff members on the Egret 2 Mini because they really liked it and they wanted to have it included on there. And I think they even managed to get the board for it so it could be dumped properly. So when you play it, it's kind of like a shoot 'em up. It's like a canoe based shoot 'em up. You move up a river and
canoe 'em up.
Yeah.
Wow.
Row 'em up. Yeah. So you move this canoe up the river and you can shoot stuff, but you also are avoiding obstacles and trying not to crash and collecting points. And it feels pretty good. You just have a button that speeds up. And one that speeds up and shoots, or with the stick, excuse me. I'm trying to remember how it plays, but either way, it's just a cute little game in that style, and it feels good. And I agree that it was worth including.
Hmm. Nice.
All right. I feel like we should mention Jungle King, aka Jungle Hunt, just because that's a game that I seem to remember being pretty pervasive at arcades at a certain point in history. Like I remember basically seeing it everywhere I went, but I never played it because it didn't actually look that good. But you basically were Tarzan, like including the Tarzan voice clip of him yodeling as he swings.
Uh-oh.
And the estate of Edgar Rice Burroughs was like, yeah, you can't do that. So they reissued it as Jungle Hunt, where you just play it as a Professor Livingston type with a pith helmet and are swinging across vines and jumping boulders and stabbing crocodiles in a river, kind of multi-format. And then there's a really terrible climactic scene where you jump over some cannibals with spears to save a blonde woman that they're trying to dip into a boiling cauldron. And then the game loops. And every time it loops, it becomes even more garish. Like it starts out with some pretty gnarly colors, but every loop, it just gets wilder and wilder. I watched a YouTube playthrough just to see it's amazing. It's like an LSD trip or something. Not that I've been on LSD, but I have to imagine that LSD is very similar to playing loop 4 of Jungle Hunt.
I've played this game. It kind of sucks. I mean, let's be honest. A lot of these games weren't that good, but I mean, especially in modern consideration. But it was interesting in that it had multiple gameplay modes with only one button, that you had to press to, or one action button and a movement button. And so you had multiple functions that you would play. And despite not being super amazing, it got ported to gosh darn everything. Like I initially played this game on the 2600, but it was on, I don't know, Coleco. It was on everything. I don't know why this one went wild, because it's not that impressive, but it does have, you know, it's got scrolling when you're in the water, stabbing crocodiles in the face and making sure that you don't run out of air. It's got, it has scrolling in the swinging sections too. And you're jumping over rocks, and it's actually like the operation of the game is fluid and feels pretty good. You know, you're not going to get hooked on it, but it's like when you jump over rocks and stuff, you actually have air control of your jump. So you can like move a little bit, and make sure that you don't like land on it necessarily. It's not much, but you have a little bit of air control, and that's, I don't know. It's got some stuff, but it also sucks.
Yeah. They did turn it into Pirate Pete at the end of everything. And that's also on the Egret. And this also has one of my favorite pages on the cutting room floor, tcrf.net, where there are multiple tables explaining and outlining every single revision and all the differences. Like, does Jungle King have vines? Yes. Does this version of Jungle Hunt have vines? No, it has ropes, and this has different palettes, and so on and so forth. It's so weirdly complicated, this single...
So much effort for this thing.
Oh, wow. A single point of origin for this game. Crazy.
I did not know about that. That's really kind of unnecessary, honestly.
Yeah. Well, they were trying to make it a thing, and they sort of succeeded.
Good job for them. Okay, so anyway, we need to kind of power through to get some of this stuff.
Yeah, let's get to the
good ones. I do want to mention Time Tunnel very briefly, just because I remember seeing this as a very young child and being like, wow, that's very interesting and I don't understand it at all. And now revisiting it many years later, I still don't really understand it. You're a train that apparently eventually travels through time, but that's not the main mechanic. It's just like when you beat a stage, you travel to another level that is, you know, like a century later. So eventually you're a steam train in like... outer space, chugging along with aliens chasing you. It's a Galaxy Express. Game.
I refuse to understand Time Tunnel.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I like Gatangatong better personally.
Yeah,
Chack and Pop, on the other hand, I think that's worth mentioning because it's not a bubble bobble game, but it's like, you know, patient zero of bubble bobble.
Well, I mean, the purple guy enemy.
Yeah, the bubble bobble for there's sure. Monstas, and I can't remember what the other guy at the top his name is, but yes, all the little guys here that you have to avoid in order to liberate your affectionate heart kisses from cages, they show up in Bubble Bobble, and it's a very Bubble Bobble-y kind of vibe for sure.
Yeah, I mean it's a weird game because you can run on any surface. You have a limited amount of jumping power, so you can't jump all the way to the ceiling or something, but you can, if there's a low ceiling, you can jump onto it and then stick to it and then walk around that. And that's
actually worth mentioning that you can't jump in the usual platformer game sense. Like you can't press a button and make Chacken, your legs the main character extend. Hop over enemies. Yeah.
Your legs extend up and you can like gain height, but you're not jumping over something. You're stilting yourself to that where you can then stand on a new surface. It's definitely an interesting game. I wouldn't say the other thing that you do is throw bombs, and you have to then kind of wait for your bomb to go off. You retreat to a safe location because you can kill yourself, kill the enemies with the bombs, bomb the cage that has a heart in it that got stolen, and then take that to the top, and then you beat that level. So it's a maze game.
You can bomb walls, you can bomb balloons that hold water and flood the stage. Like the water mechanic is very bubble bobble-ish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got some complexities to it, and it has some like emergent feeling to it, even though it isn't truly, there's no actual emergent gameplay in there, but it gives you the feeling as a player like the possibilities in this world are vast, And so I think it's important as an early entry in that kind of field where you really feel like, wow, I could do a lot of stuff with this, because you have wide control over what you can do. And there's a lot, your single action vector of bombing can do a lot of different contextual things. So it feels pretty neat.
I, you know, recently covered this in video form and discovered that the game was originally designed for PC-88 and then ported to arcades from computers, which is unusual. And then from there, it was ported to home systems.
It kind of makes sense in a way to me, like with the vibe that it has being a little different from Taito's other arcade games. It doesn't really feel as much like one of those. So I didn't know that it was originally PC 88, 98, but that kind of, I guess it would have to be 88. That kind of makes sense with my brain. Wait, PC 88, when did PC 88 come out?
Like 1980, I think.
Oh man, so long. Okay, yeah. Interesting. Well, speaking of that kind of stuff, I wanted to talk about Churro Q, because that's an MSX game from Taito. So that is developed directly for a computer/console, not released in arcades. And it's based on Takara's Penny Racer toys. So it's another early license game from them. But this is them starting to get into publishing and developing games outside of the arcade. And Churro Q is also a long-running series, basically, at this point, of racing games and stuff. Yeah. But this early one was kind of a maze game with almost Burger Time elements, where you're pushing down pieces of a Churro Q car to assemble them, and then they drive off, and then they create a little dollar sign that you can collect, and then your car, like you're creating a car by, you are a car creating cars and jumping around and driving around, and when you collect this dollar sign, then you rear up on your hind wheels. And then you can destroy all the enemies that you've been jumping over previously. And so it's got a little Pac-Man element to it. It's not the most amazing, but it's worth noting because it is, I think, their first originally developed console game that had, or non-arcade game that had nothing to do with arcades.
Yeah.
And then I also wanted to mention Space Dungeon, which is an early twin stick multi-directional shooter, which came out a year before Robotron and looks very similar to Robotron. Like in terms of the visual style and the color cycling graphics and stuff, it was developed in the US by Rex Battenberg, and it has you, this is like 1982 or three. Man, the year is important. Whatever the year before Robotron was is the year that I think it's 82. It's a multi-screen, multi-room game. And so there's a map that gets filled out at the top of the screen as you go through the different areas and get into bonus room. Yeah, it's kind of like Venture, and it's got almost like a roguelike feeling to it in a way. And I think the reason that Robotron is so much more popular is because, you know, way more enemies, and also you could tell what they looked like something. The enemies in this game are quite abstract, their shapes and stuff, and your player is just like a sphere within a sphere. But it is pretty much Robotron otherwise, which is kind of impressive when you think about it. It's another, and it's interesting to also think about the how many American developed games there were from Taito in those days. That basically stopped in the mid late 80s, but in the earlier times there were a lot, and the controversial statement that I'm gonna pose here is that after Space Invaders and before 1985, all the best Taito games were made in the US, because Space Dungeon, Kix, and Zookeeper are all US made. And those are the most contemporarily playable games in the whole bunch, in my opinion. I guess Elevator Action is 1984.
Yeah, so I was going to say, next on our list is Elevator Action. How can you
love that game?
Say that. So good.
That game rules.
It's but really
I think an argument could be made that in those years, the best games came out of the US. But Yeah, Elevator Action. Let's talk about that, because that game rules. It is it's an action platformer, and mm-hmm. you ride elevators up and down, god darn, and you shoot enemies. It's got so much modern feeling stuff to it. Like you can go faster or slower. You can control the elevator. You can go down. Well, the aim is you start at the top of a building, and then you're trying to get to the basement to your car and then get out. And
so it's a vertical shooter, but one that's totally different from all the other vertical shooters of the era. It goes the wrong direction and you shoot horizontally. It's confused. I love it.
Verticality shooter.
Yeah, it's a verticality shooter. And you can duck, you can jump, you can shoot the lights out. Like, it really makes you feel like it feels like a modern video game, or the prototype of a modern mm-hmm. video game. Mm-hmm.
The modern video game would be Elevator Action 2, which rules even harder.
Again, Jad the Taff. I very much look forward to talking about that. I love how
that's a whole episode right there.
It's a whole episode. The opening track starts with, "I'll get you next time." And then the fake saxophone comes in. Love it. Love it. But also Elevator Action, all pinks and purples and blues and stuff. I love the colorscape that they went for it. Mm-hmm. It's so pastel while being this hardcore action thing. And you can go into doors and get bonus points. And then you have a briefcase for some reason that then disappears for some other reason. I'm not really sure.
And, you know, a big thing that makes it so unique at the time, in addition to all the things your secret agent can do just as a character, as, you know, as a fighter, is the fact that you can weaponize the environment. The environment is so malleable, and you can turn it into a weapon, and that rules.
Yeah, and you can get crushed by the elevator, which I just played again last night to make sure that you could get crushed by the elevator. And,
You can. Sure, you can also fall off the elevator and die. Mm-hmm.
And different from the sequel, the elevator cord cable is a blocking factor, which I had totally forgotten about until I played it again last night. Because in the more modern Elevator Action games, more modern being, wow, it's funny because
1995, yeah,
1995. It was 11 years later than that, but is still 27 years ago. Anyway, in that game, in the newer game, you could jump on top of the elevator and keep walking across. But in the original Elevator Action, you're blocked. If you walk along the top of the elevator, you can only get to where the cable is, and it blocks you. Oh, and there are also escalators in this mm-hmm. game. That's very important. So if you wanted to have some escalator action, you could also have that.
It's kind of like an early Castlevania with the stairs.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, Elevator Action is great. I love it. It's one of those that I remember seeing back when it was new, and a very young me was like, that game seems so cool. And now that I'm older and have played a lot of different versions of it and created a lot of content about it, I can in fact say that game is still actually really cool. It's so Cold War, but it does so many things that video games would pick up in the following years. I mean, it really kind of takes the idea of being a little guy who runs and jumps from Donkey Kong and improves on it in so many ways, while still, of course, incorporating the limitation that if you fall more than like the height of your guy, you're going to die. But otherwise, Agent Otto feels much more like a contemporary video game character.
Yeah, you can duck and shoot. I mean, come on.
Yep. It's great. You can jump kick dudes.
Heck yeah.
Very big.
Maybe I will.
Wrapping up, do we want to talk about Fairyland Story, which is really like that's part of Bubble Bobble's universe.
Even several more I want to talk about. Fairyland Story is totally a Bubble Bobble-y maze game, and it really, I also wouldn't be surprised if this one started as a PC 88 game or something, but Fairyland Story really feels like a modern-ish video game. Like if someone made this game as a cute indie game with the kind of pixel graphics that it has right now, you would not bat an eye. It really feels, it has a vibe. It's got a whole thing going on, a cute little witch that shoots magic and turns people into pastries, and then you can push those pastries off the edge of a...
I think a big part of what makes it feel more contemporary than its actual vintage is the animation cycles on the pastries as they disintegrate, as you drop them or crush them or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't just kind of blink out. They have this little animation where they sort of crumble and turn into the sort of flattened version of themselves.
And her little feet animations more, too.
Yeah, it just feels a lot more like fluid and animated than you tended to see in games of this vintage, especially such cute looking games.
Yeah, I mean, it's got frames. It's got frames of animation going
frames,
on.
I love those things.
And it feels like modern, more modern graphics. Like there's multiple colors per character. The resolution is much, much higher than even Elevator Action. So you get more detail. And just the way it plays is cool. And like, if you get hit by wizard's spell, then you turn into just a hat with feet, but you can still go around and do stuff. It's super cute. There's all kinds of little nonsense in there. It's got graphical cutscenes with you flying on a dragon, really impressive, large. It doesn't feel like a game from 1984 to me. It feels like a game from 1992.
Exactly. I totally agree.
I feel like Bubble Bobble is actually visually a step back from this game.
Yep.
But, you know, it adds so much greater depth in the multiplayer element that, you know, it definitely pushes the concept forward. But this game does really feel a little bit out of its time.
Like, yeah, it's a game from the future.
It seems like it's
weird.
Yeah, for sure. And no one played it, apparently. I don't think it ever came to America.
No, I didn't know, I hardly knew anything about this game before I played it for research last night. I'll be honest. Like, I kind of like associated it with a New Zealand story. I thought it was like a prototype of that, which it's not exactly that, but it totally feels out of time. If you place yourself in the year of its release, it's like, there just wasn't this, it probably didn't succeed because it was from the future. Like, someone traveled back in time just like 6 years and put this game out there. Like, this is going to do great. And it didn't. But you should definitely, listeners of this podcast, you should check out Fairyland Story. I feel like that is absolutely ripe for a reevaluation in 2022 in terms of interesting games that may have, like, you can fully imagine some weirdo played this game a lot and loved it, like the dozens of cabinets or however many there were, and that person went on to become Hideo Kojima or something, you know. Like, this game really feels like if you played this in 1984 and you got it, you were probably on your way somewhere.
Yeah, it is on the Egret 2 Mini. So, you know, if people want a convenient way to play it in this modern
day
and age, that might be the easiest way. Oh, no, it's also on Nintendo Switch and Arcade Archives.
Very good. It's NPS also 4. In the Taito Memories Collection.
Ah, there you go. Yeah. But that's not really playable these days, is it?
It's on, if you have a PS2, it is.
Yeah, but you can't just like run out to the store and be like, no, hey, Best Buy, can I have a PS2, please?
No, so you can't do that.
There's that limitation.
Unfortunately.
But yeah, it was actually ported to quite a few systems, arcade, MSX, X68000, Switch, PS4, disk system.
Yeah, Famicom, that makes
system.
Sense.
So yeah, it's around there.
Like X68000, that's exactly where I would imagine this game originated, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It feels like they were putting down, they were laying the groundwork for the X68000 in 1984. All right. Cool. So one last game before we wrap this episode and resume sometime in the future. The Legend of Cage. My favorite ninja, Cage. He's so cool. Cage. I love him.
We all said Cage at some point. Yeah. Like, if you're old enough for Legend of Kage to have been contemporary with your life, you definitely said Cage at some point.
Yeah. We didn't know.
I mean, if you're American, that is. Yeah, we were children. We didn't know. Yeah, Legend of Kage, that's a game about jumping high. Mm-hmm. Jumping really high and shooting a shuriken in any direction and then having little kunai that you slash people with. But what I think is notable about Legend of Kage is this is where you start to get, this is the advent of Konami's hot music in a real sense. Like Konami's. This music... Oops. Taito's.
Oh, I was like, is there a secret connection here I didn't know about? Okay, yeah, Taito.
Sure. No, I'm just losing my mind. No, so Taito is known for their Zuntata group, and they had a specific soundscape that they used, especially for games like Darius. I will never say Darius, even though that's apparently how you're supposed to say it.
It is. I'm afraid.
Yeah, I can't do it.
That's okay. That's okay.
But this game is the first one that uses that soundscape and has this kind of impressive original music that is really dynamic and full of depth and has some of that FM synth and some sampling and those weird, bizarre, tinny synths that Taito liked to use that were so ear-piercing. But it's a really impressive sounding game on top of being able to jump real high and just having a huge play space. Yeah, anybody else? Does anybody have fond memories of playing it? Because for me, I was always like, I get it, but it didn't grab me as much as the music grabbed me.
I think it was a little bit too primitive for my taste when I was a kid, but I did have a friend who sort of had a appreciation for it. I think everybody sort of had a friend where like someone else likes a more fringe NES game than the ones maybe you've been playing more often, but that was one of them. I do enjoy the offshoots and sequels like Demon Sword, which plays very similarly, and also Legend of Kage 2 on DS, I think is pretty cool too.
Yeah, that's good another evolution. One of those that I just can't believe that happened.
Yeah.
So strange. Made by the same developers behind Etrian Odyssey of all things.
Yeah, DS was good days for Taito.
DS was good days in general.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I had a friend who had this game and I borrowed it from him on NES back in the day and was kind of like, I don't know, but I've gone back, you know, covering it for my video project and have developed more of an appreciation for it. I don't think it's, especially the NES version is necessarily that well made, but I respect the kind of ideas behind it and the vision behind it. It was very much attempting to capture like that sort of period drama feel of, you know, like feudal Japan. Like, you know, it starts out in the woods and then you're climbing a castle, but before you can climb the castle, you have to kind of run along the castle and you can drop into the moat and breathe through a straw to hide from enemies. And then you climb the castle and then you're in the castle interior and, you know, you're fighting ninja that are jumping at you from all directions. And then eventually there are these, you know, monks with the big helmets, the whatever those things were, like the big robot heads that have the little grill in the face for their, mm-hmm. their them to see through. It just, you know, and it has that sort of, you know, the music adheres to the Japanese classical scale. And I don't know exactly what that's called, but like it definitely kind of gives you that sense of like, yes, this is FM synthesis or NES sound chip, but imagine that it's actually shamisen and, you know, other traditional mm-hmm. Japanese instruments playing, you know, rocking out to the best of their ability with a koto, and a flute, you know, it's
this is one of Taito's first games where you get the sense that this game came from Japan. Like this game came
from
a different culture than a Western one. And,
but it's also trying to create not just like, hey, it's from Japan, but to create like, you know, to recreate a specific sort of cinematic influence, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I highly recommend that people check out the arcade soundtrack if nothing else. The game has it's got a good sense of progression because, like Jeremy said, you start somewhere and you end up somewhere else. You clearly know what path you're taking conceptually through the space. But unfortunately, the actual action of it is kind of just like you have to go to the left until it's over. Like that's
each cycle through the game, once you complete all four stages, you go to the next cycle and you're passing through the seasons. So you start in like spring mm-hmm. and then go to summer, then fall, then winter.
Yeah. You gotta invade that castle a lot.
Yeah.
Year round.
Quarterly invasion.
That's right. All right, guys, it's time to invade.
Yeah.
Back to the grind.
But yeah, it's I don't know, like going from those electromechanical machines and vodka to Legend of Kage and Fairyland Story, like there's a growth arc here. There's a story.
Definitely.
And I feel like, you know, Taito never had another hit as big as Space Invaders, but I don't know that they needed to. I feel like, you know, they made sequels to Space Invaders, but they didn't chase after the Invader thing. Like the way Namco would churn out these Pac-Man sequels for a long time, and Midway, you know, would produce their own Pac-Man sequels. And after a while, you just kind of were like, I've done this, and what's it really offering? Like Taito was just, nah, let's do something new. Let's make a Tarzan game. Let's make a ninja game. Let's make a game about a little fairy who has to turn wizards into cakes. No bounds.
10 Space Invaders games before 1995, but still.
That's like one a year. When you look in the scope of their, or no, that's not even one a year. That's like one every other year. And you know, you're looking at that in the scope of their total output. It's not that much. They didn't lean on it nearly as heavily.
Key difference is they made a lot more stuff. They just made a lot of stuff during that time period. So they had the money to experiment. And that was pretty, it yielded good results and bad results and interesting results. And those are my favorite.
Yeah. They did have the money, and so they could probably weather like an onslaught of clones from other competitors perhaps. And just sort of like, yeah, we'll just sit back and try and innovate as best we can. Like we did originally.
Yeah. Good stuff.
All right. Taito, so I think that's cool. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just saying Taito is cool.
It is. They are cool. And they're so cool that I'd like to talk about them in future episodes. So we should reconvene and do that. And we can talk about the rest of the games from 1985. We can talk about their transition into home consoles and the cool stuff they kept doing in arcades, where they were like, how many monitors can we put together in a single cabinet? And the answer, listeners, will surprise you. stay tuned for Taito Part 2 coming, I don't know, in a few months. In the meantime, thank you both for taking time out of your Sunday afternoon to talk about Taito. This is a Retronauts patron exclusive episode, so I don't have to tell you, the listener, how to listen to us because you're already here, and we thank you for that. But I will let these gentlemen tell you where you can find their work and support them and do other, like, just enjoy the cool stuff they're making. So, Brandon, how about you?
Yes, I would love it if people would wishlist our game Hyper Gunsport on Steam. That would help us, or just be aware of it in general. But wishlisting is cool. It helps Steam to know that we exist. It's a 2v2 cyberpunk volleyball with guns video game that definitely has an arcade vibe to it. And we were trying to think of how to port it, how to bring it to arcades if we ever wanted to try doing that. And the solution that I came up with was we would have to use an SNK style loop lever. We have to go back to the 80s, and without Frontline, there would be no loop lever for Ikari Warriors. And so, and without that, we couldn't port our game to the arcade. And so
I guess Frontline was
it's all the way down. And that's right. And then the other thing is, insertcredit.com. You can find the podcast that I'm on every week with Tim Rogers of Action Button, Frank Sfaldi of the Video Game History Foundation, and our host, Alex Jaffe. You can also find it on whatever podcast service, whatever one you're listening to this on, probably you could find it as well. So just look up Insert Credit. You can hear me making jokes. That's it.
All right, Ray.
Yeah, an entertaining show. I'm on Twitter as RDBAAA. I also make games, sort of. Game company Bipedal Dog. I don't have anything new to announce yet, but still trying to make games, but that's always how it goes, isn't it? And my also joking around podcast, No More Whoppers. Maybe you'll hear a promo for it on Retronauts one of these days if you haven't already. That's with my friend Alex Fraioli. We joke around about a lot of different things, mostly Square Enix games, as it turns out. Huh, I guess that's related to Taito. All right, cool. NoMoreWhoppers.com.
All right. And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter as GameSpite, doing Retronauts stuff here at Retronauts, doing Limited Run Games stuff at Limited Run Games, and on my YouTube channel, making videos that are adjacent to all those things about video games. And if you go check it out, you can watch my opinions. You can see my thoughts on games like Check and Pop, Elevator Action, Legend of Kage, and Space Invaders in person. There's a lot of Taito in there and more coming soon. Oh, Frontline. I just posted something about Frontline, so you can subject yourself to that too. So anyway, yeah, that's it. Thanks, gentlemen. We shall return to talk about more Taito in the future, but for the meantime, we're done talking for now. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.